Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Loyalty points. You can redeem them on flights, hotels, kitchen appliances. What about tuition? Yeah, you can. Higher Ed Points is the only program that transforms loyalty points into payments for school. We'll learn more from its founder, Suzanne Tyson. Then Netflix, Spotify, Amazon Prime. You probably have a lot of subscriptions charged to your credit card each month. So many, in fact, it might be difficult to keep track of them all. We'll look at a new platform called Butter that's working to help you get the most out of your subscriptions. And a joint bank account has traditionally been a sign of commitment in a relationship. You get married and as newlyweds start your lives together in the classic what's mine is yours, what's yours is mine kind of scenario. Yet more and more married millennials are choosing to keep separate bank accounts. We'll find out why from The Atlantic's associate editor, Carolyn Kitchener. Plus, live the life you want, not just the life you can afford. That's the premise behind finance expert Kristen Wong's new book, Get Money. She's here to take us through her steps to help get more money in your pocket without letting it rule your life. And other than the bad people out there, is there a way to win from rising cybercrime? We'll take a look at our new exchange-traded fund with Evolve CEO Raj Lala. All that's ahead. Let's get started. Everyone knows how expensive post-secondary education can be. From the tuition to the textbooks to the living expenses, it is a lot of money that can turn into a massive anvil of debt tied around your neck on graduation day. But what if you could use loyalty points to fund part of it? There's a program called Higher Ed Points, and it allows you to turn loyalty points into payments for school. Here to tell us more is Higher Ed Points founder, Suzanne Tyson. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. Good afternoon.
How does Higher Ed Points work exactly?
We are simply a loyalty point program reward item, and anyone can redeem their Aeroplan miles, their TD rewards points, or CIBC Aventura points for the Higher Ed Points education credit instead of redeeming for a flight or merchandise.
Right, like an elliptical or a blender or any of the other crazy things you can spend your points on. What's the money in it for you? How do you earn money on this transaction?
Right now, our sole source of revenue is on the redemption itself. And as with any item in a reward catalog, flights, merchandise, the manufacturer is paid for that reward. And so we get a small portion of the revenue from each redemption.
And so what would that margin look like?
Not enough right now.
Right. Not enough right now, but it would be what? 20%?
No, much less. Okay. I'm not allowed to disclose, but I can tell you we're a long way from black.
How many schools are participating? Because I went on the site. There's a list of schools. Many universities are listed, but not every single one. How do you work with educational partners?
Well, it's free for the educational institution to join. And in 2013, we had just two institutions on board, University of New Brunswick and Centennial College. And since that time, I have single-handedly called, enrolled every one of our 115 institutions,
wow,
including the Big East, Western, University of Toronto, UBC, and proudly we brought on the Canada Student Loan Program just a couple of months ago. And so not only can you use the program to pay for your tuition, you can use it also to repay your student loans.
Who's your target market here? Who has the number of points that they could actually make a dent in tuition costs instead of using those points for flights?
Well, the majority of our users have been the parents, aunts, uncles, and sometimes the employer of the students themselves. Students are never going to be able to accumulate the loyalty points, so we're tapping into the billions of dollars of unused loyalty points out there, and our best users have been the parents of students enrolled in university, and then some graduates themselves have used the program, but they're often tapping into their parents' points as well.
And wealthy. Wealthy people, people who for whom 100,000 points is no big deal.
No, not necessarily wealthy people. In fact, that's a misnomer. We have the average redemption is about $1,000. And we've had students, you know, get funds from their employer to pay for the extra ancillary fees that are not necessarily covered by financial aid. We have one employer who's redeemed $60,000 of his own collected points through work for scholarships.
Right.
And he sent more than half a dozen students on educational trips.
Right. And some companies, I know a plumber who puts all of his business inventory on a credit card and earns the most ridiculous number of points just by doing business.
Right. And those are the types of businesses we're trying to attract and let them know that instead of using cash from their business to either fund their own children's education or their employees' continuing education, they could use their points and preserve the cash flow for their business.
Why I think it is a wealthy person is, first of all, people have lots of points. If you're wealthy and put your family consumption through a credit card, you can earn a lot of points, even forgetting about flights. But you earn a lot of points just because you put groceries and all sorts of things on your card, but also because the educational institutions include a lot of private schools. So you can contribute through higher ed points to pay for private school tuition.
We only have four on board right now. And those institutions actually approached us. And their primary motivation was to use the program to fundraise from donations of other parents for scholarships for their students. So St. Mike's, St. Michael's College School in Toronto, was the first school to approach us after we launched. And the financial aid person there wanted to use the program to raise more scholarship and bursary funds for
schools. Interesting. Now, you know, my number one question is going to be about value and point value versus what you would get on an airplane. So I did some super simple math. You can quibble with my math, but the basic net of it is it looks like 100 points is worth about 74 cents on higher ed points versus Aeroplan 100 points is about $1.40. So if I were to spend my Aeroplan points on a flight, I would get double the value than if I put that equivalent into an educational institution. Why is the difference so dramatic?
Well, the number one reason is that every reward in a catalog is the number of miles is associated with the cost of that reward. And because we're transferring the entire value of the redemption, which is $250, there's no discounting on our reward. Flights and merchandise are offered and sold to the programs at a deep discount.
Right.
So that's
because it's Air Canada's, well, for the time being, it's Air Canada's inventory, and I guess will be in the future when they launch their own points.
Correct.
Program.
Right. And the other reason is you have to add in the taxes. Everybody forgets on flights to add in taxes. And so I was looking to travel to Moncton, and I said, maybe I'll use my Aeroplan miles. The value of the higher ed points reward was actually about $100 more because I could buy that flight on, it was November, so I could go to Moncton on a deep discount on the flight. So a lot of people look at the catalog and they say, what's the best value for my my miles? But the other factor was students. We had a mom in Alberta who'd been out of work for 4 years. She was a consultant before that and had lots and lots of points. She couldn't help her daughter financially paying with cash for her teacher's college, so she redeemed $5,000 worth of her accumulated Aeroplan miles.
Right.
So that value to her was worth way more than anything else in the catalog.
You also offer gift certificates. How does that work?
That's a new offer. And what we found was that people sometimes didn't have enough points or didn't have the right kind of points. We're trying to get every loyalty program on board. We've invited every loyalty program to participate. And if an employer, they're really for employer use. So lots of companies have tuition reimbursement. Students or grads are often, and even older people that have their income tied up, can't actually fund the tuition to take a course and then be reimbursed. So we actually are using them for tuition pre-imbursement and also to help, now that we've got the student loan programs on board, to use them to help their recent grads repay their student loans.
Why do you think Canadians are so nuts about points programs? Like we are just, I mean, people will walk over hot coals to get an extra 3 points on double points days. What does it say about us that we're so nuts about points?
It says we're thrifty. It's something for nothing. It's the best feeling in the world when you redeem for something that you haven't had to shell out cash for. And so the very early days, I actually worked in the industry. It was because we had this very ancient anti-money laundering thing or couponing thing that we had to go digital. And so Canada was the first country in the world to have a digitally organized loyalty program. Air Miles was digital, and so it was easy. You didn't have to mail anything in. There weren't stamps to deal with. So we were trained from 20 years ago to start swiping our card everywhere we went.
Interesting. Well, Suzanne, best of luck with the growth of your company, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
Suzanne Tyson is the founder of Higher Ed Points, a way to take all those points you've accumulated and you don't want to spend on a Moulinex blender. Give them to your kids for school.
Listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
We've all been there. You see a great new service, looks amazing. You sign up for a free trial, and before you know it, you're paying $10 a month for 3 years. Not that subscriptions are inherently bad, but with so many out there, you kind of got to keep track of these kinds of things over the course of time. There's this new app called Butter that tracks all of your subscriptions in one place and lets you earn cash back on them. Here to tell us more is Derek Seto. He's the founder of RedFlagDeals.com. That's his past gig, and co-founder of Butter. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Bruce.
Butter.
Who doesn't love butter, right?
I love butter. How does butter work?
Sure. So pretty straightforward. Like you said, we're all about subscriptions. We want to be the home for your subscriptions. And our goal is to make it easy for you to understand how much you're spending on what subscriptions all in one place. So you create an account on Butter. It's free to use. You connect the various payment cards that you use to pay for these subscriptions, or you can enter them by hand manually. And then we will go and match those transactions to a database of memberships and subscriptions, things like Spotify, Netflix, gym memberships, subscription block boxes, Chef's Plate, all the different types of subscriptions you may or may not have known that you currently have. And we'll tell you how much you're spending every month, how many subscriptions you have, when you're getting billed for those. We'll make it easy for you to be able to cancel and sort of deep link so you can go and find how much you've spent on that historically and change plans and all that good stuff.
This question is asked with all respect. How is that a business? How is that a business? Of all the things that I want to get people to get a handle on when it comes to their money, subscriptions does not make the top 10.
Not yet, but I think you'd be surprised because over time, you're just going to see more and more of these subscriptions. So today, things like Spotify, Netflix, even 5 years ago, didn't sort of exist in the mass market the way they do. And if you fast forward and see some of the things that people are talking about in subscriptions, there's MoviePass in the U.S. AMC announced one, which is sort of all you can eat. Go to see the movies, $10-$20 a month. Car subscriptions in the U.S. is becoming a real thing, live probably with a half a dozen manufacturers. And that's going to come to Canada. Volvo is going to be the first one with a car subscription in Canada. Now we're talking a couple $100, probably right. Like $600-$800 a month, not $10 a month. And these are all recurring. So the great thing about subscriptions is you get access. You get access to an entire catalog of music. The tricky thing with subscriptions is it does come in every single month. It's recurring, so it hits your budget every single month.
Why Butter? I hear the word butter and I think fat. Trim the fat. We think rich. You think rich.
Rich. How can we help you manage your expenses, stay rich? How do we help you think about subscriptions as something that's like smooth and easy on your budget because it is something recurring? And we do think that it's just a fun word that everybody loves. Who doesn't love butter, right?
People do. I guess there are people who are intolerant to butter, but those poor people.
It's organic.
I guess.
All this good stuff.
How's the cashback part work?
Sure. So we give you 1% cash back on your consumer subscriptions. So the way we do that is we match these subscriptions. We show you a dashboard. We make it easy for you to identify these free trials that you might want to go cancel so you can go and do that. But the ones that you want to keep and other subscriptions that we introduce you to, we give you 1% cash back on them straight out. It accrues in a balance and we pay it bi-monthly. Very straightforward. We do work with merchant partners. So you'll see like subscriptions like Instacart, like a doctor on demand subscription called Get Maple as an example, BarkBox. These are all on there right now. So we try to introduce you to new merchants that are offering subscription services that you can get value out of. And then at the same time, we will give you 1% cash back and we're generating revenue from the merchants in essence.
Well, tell me more about the business model. Who's cutting you a check? It's free to the consumer?
It's free to the consumer, and the merchants are cutting us.
So an example of a merchant, is it a merchant who's trying to sell me something new?
A merchant who's trying to introduce their subscriptions, typically. So, for instance, the BarkBox, the Instacart, the Get Maple are subscriptions we have
but
today.
But you don't get money from Spotify if I already have a subscription to Spotify.
No, we understand you better, right? So that's part of our goal is to understand you better. And the second part of our goal is to, if you have subscriptions, how do we help you actually get more value out of those subscriptions? So an easy example is, these are all the new like movies and TV shows that are going to be launched on Netflix this month. Netflix actually doesn't directly tell you, but they actually share the information with a bunch of media publications. We aggregate that as well. So we help you get more value out of the ones that you use. And then the ones you don't want to use, you can see it right there. And then you can cancel.
So you see them in your list. Do you see that you're not using them? Does Butter have a magical way to...
We don't. We are unfortunately not yet that magical. We would love to understand over time how people use them, but we can't see that. What we see is that you are, and we build you a dashboard. You don't have to basically do anything, and you'll see you have like 10 subscriptions. You're spending $120 a month. We'll give you 1% cash back on that. If you want to cancel, it's a couple links away, and then you're off to the races.
Is there anything in the platform that is a prompt to a consumer to say, what would you like to cancel this month? Because many people have, they've got Netflix, they've got Prime, they've got Crave, they've got
exactly
all these overlapping entertainment options. And for me, as someone who's trying to get people to save more, yeah, that'd be a great way for them to save some money.
Yeah, we don't actively prompt that, partly because we don't know yet what you use or you don't use. So it's hard for us to get a gauge at this point in time as to which ones you value the most. So we've only been out in market since February. And so over time, you'll actually see us add more of that functionality, what we think of as managed functionality, so that you can more easily like cancel, more easily identify things that are like free trials. You'll know when you're going to get billed next, so you can make an assessment. I think one thing that became apparent to us, and we were talking to a bunch of users, is like a lot of people are using spreadsheets, which is like super painful to try to track these things. How do we automate it for them? The other thing that happened is a lot of people do not know how many subscriptions they actually have or how much you're spending on subscriptions, or that people in their family already mutually subscribe to Spotify or to, you know, Google Drive, and you have now two people subscribing to Google Drive. Now go on the family plan, right?
You're part of RBC Ventures.
We are.
How does that relationship work? What do you get out of it? And do you have to wear a tie to work?
I don't have to wear a tie to work.
Is there foosball?
There is not yet foosball, but I think we're working on that. So RBC Ventures is sort of a new construct where we're trying to go a little bit beyond banking. And the idea is that they're creating a bunch of ventures like Butter, wholly owned, 100% by RBC, that are trying to help provide value to consumers. So our goal is not to say, hey, here's an RBC bank account. They have a whole bank and infrastructure to do that. Our goal is to help people get value out of a new service.
So you can be with any institution and use Butter.
Absolutely. So you come in and like any other service that's on the web, you can basically go in and connect whatever method or however you want to pay or put in data manually. It's sort of all up to you. We are fully bank agnostic. We just want to provide value to the consumer.
What are some of the ethical questions that you have had to deal with or will have to deal with on this path? And I ask because if you're paid by companies that sell subscriptions, it is not in your vested interest to say, hey, Canadians, time out. No more subscriptions. You've got 10. Stop. We know you can't, you got $2,000 in credit card debt. You can't get another subscription. What I would be able to say to a consumer, because I couldn't care less. I'm not paid by anybody.
Well, we actually don't know how much credit card debt people have and so on and so forth. But I think what we're trying to get to is like actually tell people what they're spending first and foremost so they can make a value-based decision on how they want to spend their money, right? So knowing is sort of the first step. And then they should subscribe to the services that provide value, right? Like we don't want the consumer to be beholden to subscription services. And that's actually, I think, part of what we're trying to solve is to help people understand, manage, and control what they're spending on subscriptions. And that does mean that the better, stronger, more valuable subscription services are going to survive and you're going to get more cancellations out of the other ones. But what's net good for the consumer, we ultimately think is net good for Butter because our whole goal is help the consumer.
Are you going to have a brand for vegans?
We're going to have, I don't know if you can have vegan butter. Is it
you
possible?
You can't. No, you can't have vegan butter, I'm afraid. I've just pointed out a massive flaw.
Massive market.
Marketing.
You can have vegan meat. So maybe one
turducken.
Day.
Or no, it's not turducken. It's tofurkey.
It's impossible food.
That should
all that
be
type
the name. Your business should be tofurkey instead or tofu. Maybe next go round. Yeah. Derek, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Derek Zito is co-founder of Butter, a new service that aims to help you track your subscriptions better. Well, here's a subscription that would be worth your time. Go onto iTunes and subscribe to this podcast. That's super smart. You can also, and doesn't cost any money. Neither does following me on Twitter at Bruce Celery, Facebook, Bruce Celery, Moolala. Stay with us. Coming up next on the program, why more married millennials are keeping separate bank accounts. The Atlantic's associate editor, Caroline Kitchener, will be here. And later, tips from finance expert Kristen Wong on how you can get money so you can live the life you want, not just the life you can afford. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Celery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
We've all heard that the millennial generation is getting married later than previous generations. When they finally decide to tie the knot, it's probably no surprise that they do things differently. In so many ways they do, especially when it comes to their personal finances. More and more married millennials are choosing to keep separate bank accounts, impacting how a newly marrying generation manages their money. Here to tell us more is Carolyn Kitchener. She is an associate editor at The Atlantic, and she joins us from Washington, D.C. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me on.
This was a Bank of America study. What did they find?
Well, they found that millennials are more likely to keep their money either partially or completely separate when they get married. It really wasn't a surprise to me. I'm, 26, and talking to my friends as we're thinking about, getting more serious in our relationships, getting married, it's really hard to think about keeping money together.
Why is that? I am clearly older than you, and it's just the way that it is done in my
generation. But for us, I don't know. There's something about it that doesn't feel quite natural. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. But for all of my friends that I talked to, this was the hang up. Definitely see ourselves getting married, having these serious relationships, but not merging the bank account.
Tell me why. Why do you think this is?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. I think the main pretty obvious one is that millennials are much, much, much more likely to be living with their partner before they get married. And when you're living with your partner, you're much less likely to be sharing your bank account. So, you're living together, you're splitting the rent, you're splitting the groceries, you're splitting the utilities. You're used to that. You've come around to that. So, why make the change if it's something that you're used to and it's something that's working? I think that's the big obvious reason. But I think, there are a couple other ones too. I mean, money, I think, is quite closely tied to identity. Millennials are getting married later, and because of that, we're further along in our careers. So our careers mean more to us. They say more about who we are, and the paycheck is a part of that. If you make a lot of money, you feel good about that. That's part of who you are.
What do you think? How do you think the gender dynamic plays out here?
Well, I think that, women now are earning more than they ever have before. We've got great jobs. We are likely to be making, more money than our partners when we get married. And I think that the interesting dynamic at play here is that this is a relatively recent thing. Not too long ago when women got married, that just meant that your husband paid for everything, and that's not the case anymore. And many of the people that I spoke to said that having a joint bank account and having a woman kind of give up her claim to her money that she made herself, that felt dated somehow. That felt backwards. That didn't feel equal.
If you were to move the clock forward, how do you think you will be if and when you marry and choose to have a child? Because we just did an interview on the gender pay gap, and the results are just so super annoying and super heartbreaking to me anyway, as the parent of an 8-year-old girl. How do you think it may change when there's a kid and you may either be on a maternity leave for a short period of time or choose to take a pause out of your career and don't have money of your own?
I think that's a great question. I think TBD, we'll see. But many of the couples that I spoke to said that this whole thing was about trust. Some of the experts that I talked to said, oh, no, how can the millennials be doing this? Marriage is about trust. They need to trust each other. They need to have joint bank accounts. But ironically, many of the millennials that I spoke to said that, it was more of a sign of trust to keep your finances separate because they said, we trust each other enough that if one of us isn't working, if we're out of a job, if we're on maternity leave, if something happens and we don't have our own flow of income, we trust that the other person is going to step in and step up and pay for whatever we need.
How do you think about retirement savings in this context? And you acknowledge you're 26, so I know it's different than if you were 46. But one of the financial principles of retirement is that you want people to have a similar size of nest egg when they retire, because you're going to pay less tax than if one has an enormous nest egg and the other one has a teeny tiny nest egg. Logistically, that's a little easier to do when finances are combined.
Well, I mean, it's like I said, Bruce. I mean, I think this is about each partner having a little pot, or maybe a big pot, of their own. It's not necessarily that there's no sharing that goes on. That's not it at all. And I think that, you know, if, you know, in the kind of relationship that I'd like to have, if, you know, both people have been keeping finances separate, you get to retirement and, you know, the pots are pretty different in size, there's a lot of sharing that goes on. You want to live your life together. You're not going to, you know, live in, you know, two separate apartments based on what the individual can afford. That's not it at all. Mm. It's just, it's keeping some for yourself so you can feel like you have some autonomy.
How do you get on the same page in terms of the grand vision for what is important in life and how you spend that money? Because if we use a kitchen analogy and each person makes their own dinner, sure, you sit at the table together, but you made pasta and I made, you know, pork tenderloin, but we didn't make it together. We made our own food and we're eating it together, but we didn't make it together. How do you come up with a shared vision for your finances in the absence of that combination?
Well, I think that's more about the kind of relationship that you have. I mean, I think if you don't have that shared vision, having a shared bank account isn't necessarily going to help. I mean, you need the shared vision first, and then you can think about how to pay for it. I mean, I think it says something, you know, that's wrong. It says something about what's wrong with the relationship if, you know, you need that money to be combined before you can have that shared vision.
It's just so much easier. My gosh, it's so much easier because when it's coming, when people are really aware of where the dollars are coming from and going to, it's much easier to make the priority calls, especially if the two people in the couple have different temperaments. One is a spender and one is a saver.
Yeah, well, you know, it was interesting. I mean, the couples that I spoke to actually said that this made them fight about money less. You know, they said that, you know, part of the reason they made this decision is because they knew that the number one thing that couples fight about is money. And, you know, they saw this, you know, having a pot of their own, you know, from which they could draw, you know, say if the, you know, the woman wanted to spend a lot of money on sports games and the guy wanted to spend a lot of money on, you know, a vacation to Hawaii.
Yeah.
You know, they could do that and it wouldn't cause as much conflict.
Very interesting. Relationships and money, ever fascinating. Thank you for joining us to weigh in on this sort of new trend. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Bruce.
Carolyn Kitchener, Associate Editor at The Atlantic. She joined us from Washington to talk about why more and more millennials are keeping their bank accounts separate. Stay with us. Coming up later, we'll take you through the Moolala questionnaire with Derek Zito. But next, live the life you want, not just the one you can afford. We'll find out how to do that from finance expert Kristen Wong. She's got a new book out called Get Money. If you have a question about money, I might have already answered it somewhere. Who knows? I'm the money columnist for Money Sense. You can find those articles online at moneysense.ca. Then search for me. Stay with us. There's more Moolala after the break.
Listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Managing your money is kind of like going to the dentist or standing in line to renew your driver's license. Nobody wants to do it, but you kind of have to get your teeth cleaned and renew your license and manage your personal finances. But maybe there is a way to get it all done in an easier, less stressful fashion. Kristen Wong's joining us. She's a financial journalist with Life Hacker, The New York Times, and the author of Get Money, Live the Life You Want, Not Just the Life You Can Afford. She joins us now from Los Angeles, California. Hello there.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show.
You dedicate this book to your parents, and you include a quote, "Money doesn't buy happiness, but let's find out just to be sure." I love that quote, and I'm fascinated to hear the anecdotes about your family. How did they influence your views about money and this book in particular?
Well, you know, my parents, we grew up with not a lot of money, and it held us back in a lot of ways. There were things I wanted to do as a kid that we couldn't afford to do. We couldn't afford to go on vacation. My parents were always working. Money was always a source of stress for them. And I saw how their relationship with money kind of changed. They were kind of personal finance nerds. Like, they were trying to figure out how to improve their financial situation, and they did. And by the time I was older, I saw how their lifestyle changed because of money. And so that had a really big impression on me. And I really saw that, hey, if you learn a little bit about how this tool works, how this money thing works, your life
can change in some pretty significant ways. Suddenly they were able to afford to go on vacation. They didn't argue about money as much. And that's not to say money is going to solve all of your problems, but I think it does solve some problems, right?
Yeah.
Like if you have a problem paying rent, then money's going to help you solve that.
It is a very colloquial take on money, including swearing. You swear repeatedly in this book, which I'm sure you're not allowed to do when you write for the New York Times. Why did you decide to use the voice that I can imagine you would use if you were talking to a group of friends in a pub?
Well, I think it's just more accessible that way. It's almost not even a conscious thing. It's just how I would talk.
You swear like that in real life? My God, I'm putting a swear jar into practice there. All of like $50 before lunch.
Well, it's a good way to make a few extra bucks that way. But yeah, it's just, I think people, you know, and not everybody's a fan of it, but I think people just respond better, not just to the way that the tone in which you're writing, but also like I use a lot of personal anecdotes in the story about how money has impacted me. Like, what does it look like to open a 401k? Because if you just tell people, here's the process you need to go through to open a 401k, well, they're going to kind of tune out. Like, you need to see what that looks like in fact.
401k. It's an RSP in Canadian language. Super boring. It's just so boring. And now you write, you frame the book in three stages. What are the stages and why did you decide to structure it this way?
Well, because I so the first stage is just kind of figuring out the basics of your money, just learning how your money works. And then the second stage is optimizing your money. So, you know, after you figure out how your money works, well, the first stage is just called power up. So that's just kind of like if you're feeling low about money, you really don't feel like you have any power or control over it. This stage is going to help you. It focuses on small wins to help you feel more and more like you can do, you know, personal finance. You can do this money thing. Stage two is to optimize your finances. So I kind of like to explain that, like, you know, you're figuring out how the machine works in stage one. Stage two, you're making it a well-oiled machine. So it's more efficient ways to handle your money. So like finding a better bank, figuring out how to spend money more mindfully, that sort of thing. And then the third stage of the book is called grow, and that's pretty self-explanatory. That's when you're going to figure out how to make your money grow. So that's like negotiating, picking up a side hustle, investing, stuff like that. And I think, you know, it's just the book is very much focused on helping people feel, helping the readers feel like they have control over their money. I feel like most of the time we feel the exact opposite, right? Like most people feel like money controls them. And I really think like in my own financial journey, feeling in control, like I was in the driver's seat, that changed everything. Like my financial situation turned around completely. And there's research on this that shows like even when you just feel a sense of control over your money, even if you don't have control over it, you actually make better saving decisions. You make better financial decisions when you have this, you know, when you feel powerful, because you want to maintain that feeling of power. So then you make better money decisions to maintain that control and that power. So it's just, I don't know, it's so psychological. And I kind of wanted to write the book from that. You know, it's very much a mindset thing. There's some, you know, black and white rules about personal finance that are never going to change, but it's so behavioral. And so the book is very focused on habits and behavior.
You have a chapter on supercharging your debt payoff plan, which I loved. And you talk about the Doc Martens you bought with your brand new credit card. But somehow a $100 pair of boots became $1,900 in outstanding debt. How did you resolve that for yourself? How'd you get rid of it?
Well, I actually used the snowball method, and I don't know if your listeners are familiar with the snowball method.
Yeah, we've talked about it, but worth recapping.
Yeah, so it's when you focus on paying off your smallest debts first, and speaking of behavior, like, that just makes you feel more in control. So when you pay off that, you know, when you pay off your smaller debts, you are motivated by that, and you're like, wow, I can really do this, so I'm going to keep going. So that's the way that I did it. You know, I had the credit card with those Doc Martens on them from back in the day. And after I graduated college, I had a student loan. And so I used the snowball method and I prioritized the debts that I had. And I focused on paying off the smaller ones first so that I felt motivated by that. And I felt like I could get a taste of what it was like to be debt free. And then eventually I did become debt free.
Do credit card balance transfers work? They seem like such a shell game and fraught.
I know. It's a dangerous thing to just jump into, I think, but they can work, and I've used them myself, but there are so many caveats that you want to consider. You want to read the fine print when you do a balance transfer. You know, their credit cards don't offer things like that unless they profit from them. Mm. So, you know, they can work where it's basically you transfer your balance to a new card with, you know, 0% interest. So you kind of get to skip out on the interest and you can make more progress. But yeah, there's just, you want to make sure you know what you're getting into, see if there are any fees associated with it, because if there are balance transfer fees, it might end up costing you more than it's worth. So, you know, anything that's like a credit card offer, I usually caution people to, if it sounds too good to be true,
it should go directly into the shredder. Budget like you're building a house. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think like with a house, you have your foundation, right? And I think with a budget, your foundation is your goal. Like, what is your financial goal? Why do you want to get out of debt? Why are you reading a book about money? Why are you listening to a show about money? What is it about? It, you know, money is just a tool at the end of the day. It's not good or bad, it's just a tool. What do you want to use that tool for? Is it to travel? Is it to make sure that your family feels fed and clothed and comfortable? Whatever your goal is, that should be the basis for creating your budget. Otherwise, when you have to say no to something because you're saving money, it's just going to feel like restricting yourself. So you don't want a budget to feel restrictive. You want to give yourself something to say yes to so that you can say no to other things. And I think that is the foundation of your budget, having a goal in mind. So when you say, no, I can't go out with my friends, it's for a reason. It's because you're saving up for this trip. If you're just doing it to be, I'm a responsible adult and I need to have a budget because that's what responsible adults do, chances are you're not going to stick to the budget.
Do you have one? Do you use one? A budget?
A budget?
Yeah.
I sure do, yes. And I am kind of a money nerd, so
I'm a money nerd, but I don't have a budget.
What do you have? What do you use?
Nothing. I just always spend less than I have. Makes my life very, very simple. Save first, that's all I do.
You have that habit, you don't have to.
And I dumpster dive for dinner as well.
Well, that always helps.
Yeah, that makes it much easier. I wish we could talk all day. Kristen, thank you for joining us and congrats on your book. Writing books is a stupid idea. They're way too hard.
They are very hard.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk about it. That's easy. Kristen Wong, a writer with Lifehacker, New York Times, and the author of Get Money, Live the Life You Want, Not Just the Life You Can Afford. She joined us from LA today. Stay with us. Coming up next, we'll learn more about how investors can protect themselves and also profit from cybersecurity. We'll take Derek Zito through the Moolala questionnaire. If you're looking for some other books to help you with your personal finances, in addition to the one we just talked about, I've written a couple myself. How's that? Moolala Guide to Rocking Your our Retirement Savings Plan is the second of the two. Available online everywhere. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Data breaches, data hacks, they've been making the headlines with alarming frequency lately. But perhaps there is a way to benefit from this trend without being criminal about it. Turns out you can actually invest in an exchange-traded fund that focuses on cybersecurity. Joining us now is Evolve CEO Raj Lala. How are you doing?
I'm great, Bruce. How are you?
A cybersecurity ETF. Why do you think investors should be looking at the cybersecurity industry?
Well, I think, you know, the cybersecurity market has changed so much, and that's a consequence of how much hackers have changed and become so innovative. But, you know, to take the 30,000-foot view, when you look at our world today and the way it's moving, right now we have about 20 billion devices that are connected. That works out to be about 3 per person.
Wow.
It's a lot. It's growing to, it's expected over the next 5 years, that number is going to go to 75 billion. I mean, right now I'm sitting at my desk and I have 8 going at one time, including my Fitbit watch. So when you think about how connected we all are today, it increases the need for cybersecurity. It increases the opportunity for cyber criminals to hack into our world, per se. And when you think about, you know, cyber crime 5-10 years ago, the first thing that most people think of is that blue screen of death. Remember, you had it on your laptop or your desktop?
Oh, yes.
where your system locked up, and then you basically had to throw away your hard drive after that because you couldn't figure out a way to fix it. But there was no economic model to that. There was no economic benefit to the hackers to actually plant that worm or that Trojan horse into your system. Now they've become so much smarter. You have things like ransomware. You have phishing. You have individuals hijacking your data and holding it for ransom and saying to you, give me X thousand or X million dollars and I will give you back your data. And actually many times they will do that. So it's changed a lot. And because it's changed, it's become so much more important for organizations, not just us as individuals, but organizations to protect their data. So right now it's projected that over the next few years, cybercrime is going to cost the global economy $6 trillion.
That's a fair amount of money. That's a trillion with a T. Now, tell me about one or two of the names included in this ETF.
So a lot of the names would not be necessarily familiar to most people. One that you definitely would be familiar would be Symantec, which owns Norton Antivirus as well. They're doing a lot of the consulting, not just for small business, but also large businesses as well. But there's other organizations that are fairly large, like Checkpoint or Akamai, that are effectively taking care of the cybersecurity services for a lot of the Fortune 100 and Fortune 500 companies. So providing the hardware support, the software support, and the consulting. And, you know, what I think is an important point to recognize is that most large organizations are contracting out the lion's share of their cybersecurity to external firms. So they're not actually doing a lot of it in-house. And part of the reason for that is a massive shortage of human capital or human talent as it relates to the cybersecurity space. So a lot of the companies in our portfolio are benefiting from the large organizations contracting them to help with that hardware, software, and consulting.
How is this Evoked set chosen? Is that something that you do, or is it based on an index that pre-exists? And if that's the case, how do they make the choice on what goes in and what doesn't?
Yeah, we use something called FactSet, and FactSet is effectively a classification system, and you're correct, it's an index-based ETF, so there is no active management related to the product. We rebalance it on a quarterly basis, but it's effectively all companies that fall into the categorization of cybersecurity services.
Now, there is a big difference between revenue growth and share price growth, right? There's been so many trends where people are all jazzed about cannabis or blockchain or whatever the flavor du jour is. What would you say about the valuations of the underlying companies here? How should people be thinking about that and where it is in the cycle?
Yeah, I think if you look at it purely in from a numerical perspective, they're trading at fairly high multiples, a lot of the companies. But as you know as well as I do, a lot of it's based on demand. And I think when most people look at cybersecurity right now and cybercrime, I think everyone will agree that it's going to continue to increase over the next 10 years. It's going to morph into other areas that we don't even know about. So the demand proposition is so strong. You're never going to hear a CEO of a major Canadian bank after a bad quarter of financial results turn around and say, oh, geez, you know what? We're going to have to decrease our spending on cybersecurity because we had a bad quarter. It's something that is a non-discretionary spend. So therefore, you're going to see continuously more contracts for these organizations, which obviously generates more revenue for them, which should ultimately generate more growth.
Where are the risk factors for the sector? Because, you know, IT, you say it's non-discretionary. I think some people would beg to differ with you on that, given that IT is something that ebbs and flows with business fortunes over time, despite the pronounced PR risk that the companies are exposed to. But what are some of the risk factors for these companies?
I think some of the risk factors would be that they're not necessarily staying ahead of the cyber criminals. They're not spending enough on R&D because the whole game is to stay ahead of the criminals. In fact, what's interesting is that a lot of these cyber security organizations are actually run by former hackers themselves, because in order to beat the criminals, you need to have that kind of mindset. So I definitely think the biggest risk would be that. I think you're right. It is technology, although it's a different kind of technology. You remember this year we had some pretty significant volatility in the tech sector. Basically, towards the end of January to mid-March, the NASDAQ dropped by about 10%. Cybersecurity firms actually during that period were up about 10% in that same period of time. So they're a little bit different. They're not producing some kind of widget or new area of technology. This is really focused on contracts with the big organizations.
I love it. And being a convicted felon could actually be a plus on your resume. That's you can't say that for everywhere.
That's correct.
Raj, thank you very much for the context. And what's the ticker? I should get the ticker from you. What's the ticker on the CTF?
It trades on the Toronto Stock Exchange, and the ticker is CYBR, as in cyber.
CYBR. I like it. It's catchy. Raj Lala, Evolve CEO on the cybersecurity ETF, now available to buy and sell in the Canadian marketplace.
Thanks, Bruce.
Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire. Our guest is Derek Zito. He is the co-founder of Butter, this new service that helps you manage all your online subscriptions. Derek, the first thing that comes to your mind.
Sure, let's go.
How would you describe your money personality?
I'm a deal shopper, so I need to find a deal on everything.
Even before you founded Red Flag Deals, you were a deal shopper?
That was the whole reason I founded it. It was not designed to be a business. It was just to help me find deals.
Now, if you go back to your childhood, were you a deal shopper back then?
Well, less so. I think like over time, I think you obviously learn the value of money a little bit more and how much work it takes to earn whatever it is. But as soon as I started making some of my own money and I was a poor student, I definitely became a deal shopper.
When is a deal not a deal?
Unfortunately, and I do this a lot, when you spend way too much time doing the research for probably a savings of like a minimal amount.
Cents.
So you can save like a couple bucks, but if you spent like an hour to save a couple bucks or like an hour to save
have
10
you ever
bucks,
bought things you don't actually that you don't actually love after you've bought them? I've been trapped into deals in clothing stores where I bought the shirt that was a large, but I'm a medium.
Return policies, hopefully.
I guess, but I'm too lazy. So have you ever had any bad experiences being deal-oriented?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think actually it's more of I tend to buy things that are a good deal that I don't end up using. So they actually just sit in my basement or sit in the garage. I don't actually get any use of them. I should probably go return them, but I was a great
or
deal.
Or put them on buns.
Exactly. Sell them on Kijiji. I'm also too lazy to sell them on Kijiji.
Oh, right.
So not enough time.
That's your business idea number three. Who was your money mentor growing up?
It was definitely family. Like I had an uncle actually, who, we grew up like fairly like frugal and, it's not like there was a ton of money flying around. So we tried to like make the most of it. Right. And how do you go and like use, public resources, libraries, all of these things and just have a good time not having necessarily to spend money.
What is one financial behavior you yourself are still working on? Or are you perfect?
No,
I'm
horrible. I spend a lot of money. I sort of spend money in two ways. Like I do a ton of research, and then what I typically see is I'll sort of buy, great deals on the other end, and then sometimes I'll go overboard and just buy, arguably the high end, the best stuff. So I'm very,
Do you pay full price on your cocaine? Is that what you're saying?
I think that might actually be a good thing.
Right, if you do, because then you can buy as much. I'm kidding about the cocaine. I'm totally kidding about the cocaine. So you do sometimes, I will splurge.
So I will basically save and then on certain things we'll just splurge and maybe
example,
I shouldn't.
For example?
Vacations is one.
Vacations.
When I was in school, I probably bought an engagement ring that was way too expensive.
Did you end up marrying the person?
Yes, I did. So it was
and
successful.
Are you still married to the person?
Yes. I probably wouldn't bring it up otherwise.
You amortize that over the course of decades. I'm sure that's fine.
No matter what you spent,
as long as you stay married, it's fine. What was your worst financial mistake so far? So I say so far because maybe it's ahead of you. I don't know.
So startups are a tricky thing. Because in many cases, they don't work. The odds are against you. I've certainly done a bunch of angel investments that went to zero. I've certainly been involved in startups that were probably negative, from a return on investment perspective of my time. And they're super high risk. So angel investments have probably been some of the worst investments
right.
I've made so
You've
far.
Had a great time. You've met some great people. But bupkis, that's what you got. Bupkis.
But you learn something along the way, I hope.
What is one thing you still worry about when it comes to money?
I think it's more about for me, family planning, like future generations. I have two kids. How do we ensure that, they are set up and are comfortable, but at the same time they have, the right values and approach to money so that they
can also... What is one value you want to ensure that you imprint on them?
I think you have to, be self-sustainable. So you have to be in a position where you can go and make a living to meet your needs and you can't rely on... whether it be, you know, family or whether it be, you know, your employer to provide that for you. Like, you have to be self-sustainable and have the skills that you don't have to worry about, you know, what's going to happen.
Are you going to teach them how to shop the deals?
I don't know. Sometimes I'd rather teach them like life skills. I'd rather teach them like, you know, employment, valuable skills, how to code, all these things that will help them.
I guess that's good. You know, earn. Go to the bakery and buy day old and then microwave it for 10 seconds and resell it as freshly baked. It's a good idea. You're skeptical.
I'm a little skeptical.
Derek Seto on the Moolah Law Questionnaire. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's our program for today. If you want to join in on the conversation, drop us a line at ask@moolahlaw.ca or tweet at Bruce Celery, Bruce Celery Moolah Law on Facebook. So many options. Our website has former or past programs, also past segments. So you can go get caught up over at moolahlaw.ca. Thank you very much for listening today. Have a great day.